Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel.
I want to talk with you about a very important subject today. The yearning that we all have for what, in a humorous way, at the Miss America pageant, you know, the idea that they're asked questions and what's the one thing that you would like to see in the world, all the girls are asked, and do you recall what it is? World peace, right? And there's a funny movie, Miss Congeniality, which makes fun of that, et cetera, et cetera. Although we make fun of that, there is a deep yearning that we all have that things would be better in the world, you know? And the question we have today that we're going to touch on just in the next few minutes is, what's God's program for that? Or what's the essence of God's program? We're not going to touch on the whole thing. I don't think we understand the whole picture. We can learn some things. The problem we have is this feeling of being powerless, or relatively powerless, in a world of swirling forces that A, we don't really understand very well, and B, even if we did, what would we do about them? Have you ever had that emotion before? And you know, in the Bible, there's a rather poignant passage in the book of Revelation when it talks about what will develop as a world power that's going to be very evil, and that's coming one day in the future, and it's called the beast in the symbolism of the book of Revelation. And then it says, it quotes the people at the time and how they feel about this all-powerful, pervasive force. I'll quote this to you from the book of Revelation, chapter 13 and verse 4, people will say, they worship the beast and asked, who is like the beast? Who can wage war against it? And so the sense of powerlessness is the thing that motivates them to worship the beast, because what else are we going to do? Now, I would like to suggest an answer to the question, how do we, given the circumstances, given our relative smallness, given the huge, powerful, pervasive, swirling forces around us, how do we change the world? That is the question that we're asking today. And I would like to allow Yeshua's example to guide us. I'd like to, again, go over this passage from Luke 5 with you. So if you want to follow along, feel free. Luke 8, verses 1 through 17. Soon afterward, Yeshua was in a town called Nain, or Nain, and his disciples in a large crowd went along with him. So here Yeshua is in his role, and if you want the big word for it, he is a peripatetic rabbi. Peripatetic means that he would walk from one place to another, and he would teach. He would go to the little towns throughout Israel. And he was a rabbi called rabbi, and so he was a peripatetic rabbi. He would walk around to the different places. And this town of Nain has been identified. It's in the lower Galilee, not far from the Judean border, not far from Mount Tabor, interestingly enough. It says, as he approached the town gate, a dead person was being carried out. So I want you to picture the scene. So you have a little town. It's actually big enough to have a town gate. It was an area that you'd enter through, a protective gate. And imagine a crowd of, we'll say, as a guest in it, 50 people. And they are accompanying this dead body out of the town, because you wouldn't bury the dead person within the precincts of the town proper. And they're carrying him out. And Yeshua, with a big crowd, call it 200 people, we're making that up, but just to give a sense, that they're approaching, and these two groups encounter each other right at the town gate. And so we learn that this was the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. Now, when we think about that, this is a very, very sad situation. It represents the kind of seemingly irrational evil that we all know about and sometimes encounter personally, but you read about in the papers every day, and you say, how could that happen to that family, that person? This person was too young to die. And that's what we have here. How old was he? We're not told. I'm imagining that he was a na'ar, a teenager, but that's my imagination. He was important to his mom because She loved him. On two Thursday nights a month in our sanctuary, we have a group that meets here called Compassionate Friends. And these are people who gather because they lost a kid. And there are very, very few painful experiences that can be compared to losing a child. And we have people in our own sanctuary who have experienced this in the past. So she is feeling devastated, the loss of this child that she loved. And also, she's a widow, and in Israel, the classes of people who are over and over again named as the most vulnerable people are orphans and widows. And so she's in that group. How did he die? We don't know. We don't know how he died. Could have been an accident in the field. It could have been he got sick. Maybe he was beat up by some tough kids and hit his head on a rock. I don't know. We don't know. But he's dead. He's gone. And she is desperate. And so the two crowds encounter each other. And I imagine the flute players and mourners stop because that was to help facilitate grief. But in this moment, this encounter of the large group of Yeshua's followers and another group accompanying her to bury her son, there's a moment of silence. Yeshua then approaches. When the Lord saw her, his heart went out to her, and he said, "Don't cry." How could she not cry? But Yeshua, I imagine, said it with a bit of a smile, knowing what he was about to do. So he then went up and touched the bier or the stretcher that was carrying him on, and the bearer stood still. So you imagine Yeshua interrupts the normal protocol of the funeral. He touches, stops the people walking forward with the stretcher, and I imagine everyone is quiet. His followers had seen what he'd been able to do, and they're wondering, what's going to happen now? And a kind of moment of suspended in time, a moment of some kind of disorientation, but then Yeshua breaks the silence. "Young man, I say to you, kum," or come, the imperative, "rise up." The dead man sat up and began to talk. "Ma, who are you?" And everyone, it goes crazy. This is an amazing moment. Yeshua says, "Come here, give me your hand, son." Helps him up, gives him to his mom. What a moment of Jewish history. Can you get a handle on that for a minute? Okay? Now, I want to make some observations. It says they were all filled with awe and praised God. "A great prophet has appeared among us," they said. "God has come to help his people." Echoes of the Exodus. I don't know if it's intentional, but it's part of the paradigm in the Bible of God's showing up at the last minute and helping Israel through its toughest things. So we have that echoes of the Torah portion, as I mentioned. So then it says, the news about Yeshua spread throughout Judea and the surrounding country. Now, I want to set this in the context of real things that you experience and we experience, and I want to talk about Yeshua's approach. Seemingly irrational evil. He shows up, and it's in the moment. It's dealing with regular people. He's not initiating a huge political or social campaign. He is just in this, call it existential moment. He's showing up, and a need presents itself, and he's there, and he makes it all right. Now, that's very important. It's not part of some grandiose thing that's happening here. In one sense, we could say it is, and that it's all part of his coming. But in terms of making the world better, I think there's a lesson for us, which we're going to see. Not a program, but an awareness of the needs which surround us. I want to talk about this in terms of a multiplier effect. A multiplier effect, God's program, a multiplier effect. Now, the multiplier can work for evil as well, but in this case, it works for good. Because, what does it say? The word about him spread throughout all Judea. Why is Judea mentioned? Why not the Galilee? Well, because it's physically near Judea. But I think that Luke, as he writes in Luke Acts, always has a kind of emphasis on Judea and God's plan through the King of David, the Son of David, and the emphasis on the Jewish role in the equation. We won't explore that more. But what I do want to talk with you about in a few minutes is about, well, a real example of the multiplier effect that is taking an evil thing and bringing good, not through some huge program, but by dealing with the realities. Let me be very specific. Maybe you saw on the news yesterday, and it's been in the New York Times, it's been all over, that there is a fellow named Larry Nassar who has been convicted of abusing at least 100, it was probably much more, young athletes, high school athletes in Michigan. Are you familiar with this at all? Okay, you're aware of it. Well, this problem is very close to home for our synagogue, and I'll tell you why. Because it was Serena Nickel, her sister, Larissa, they were the Michelle family. Larissa was one of the athletes. And we watched her on TV yesterday in this unprecedented court hearing in Michigan where sentencing was going to occur, but they're allowing days for this to allow these girls, again, roughly 100 of them, to speak directly to the guy who abused them. And so Larissa got up, and first her dad got up, Bill Michelle. Bill has been here. You've met Bill. The evil you, Larry Nassar, have done went even far beyond the hundreds of girls whose lives have been damaged. Marriages have been ruined. Suicides have occurred. You see the multiplier effect of evil there? Right? And so it was really quite something. Then Adam, Larissa's husband, spoke. I'm just giving you little snippets. The effects of Larry Nassar's actions caused depression, insomnia, nightmares in him. And then he says, my wife experienced shingles, a young girl with shingles, because of the dynamics of the abuse and the fact that no one paid attention to her. No one believed her. And that's the story of so many of these. And then Larissa spoke and said, many physical effects, shingles, migraines, depression, insomnia, nightmares. I was woken up in the middle of the night, drenched in sweat. My life is only one of thousands of lives which have been affected by you, Larry Nassar, looking him right in the eye. Why did she say thousands of lives? I thought only 100 or such number of people were affected. Because whole families are affected. The multiplier effect of evil is profound. But how about the multiplier effect for good? Because that is what we see in the program for making the world a better place. Let me just briefly tell you about a book that I want to encourage you all to read. It's called Not by the Sword, and it is the story of a cantor and his wife who moved to a city. They kept getting notes and phone calls from a fellow named Larry Trapp, who was the Grand Master of the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan of Nebraska. You'll be sorry you moved into 5810 Randolph Street, Jew boy, among many of the comments. How did this cantor and his wife respond? They chose to seek out this man, who turned out to be a pathetic character, very ill physically, lived alone. They sought him out and showed him kindness. The story continues that he was so taken by their acts of kindness to him despite all of his threats. I'll quote Larry Trapp. They showed me so much love, I couldn't help but loving them back. And he converted to Judaism, ultimately. Isn't that an amazing story? True story. But what we see here is the multiplier effect for good or evil. Now, how can you change the world? I want to quote a rock song. Love the one you're with. Start at home. Don't talk about loving humanity. If you're mean to your wife or mean to your husband, forget about it. It doesn't work that way. Love the one you're with. Start at home. Love the people in the synagogue, because it's the people you relate to. It's loving people in your world. You start there. It's being kind to the checkout person who often is just ignored, not even thought of as worth engaging. But you ask her how she's doing, what's new, what's cooking, you know. You validate her or him. And then you spread it to the people in your town, in your area. There's no real rule here, because it's not a matter of an overarching political or social movement as such, though we don't want to trivialize that either. Again, everything's more complicated than simplistic, just one way is the whole thing. It's not the way it is. But we can see emphases, and we can see a way forward which takes us from powerlessness to power. And Larissa and the other girls during this several-day court hearing are empowered because they are able to do good in their situation. And it just so happens, it's a pattern plan for changing the world, that thousands, if not millions, of people have either read about it in the press or are going to see these girls talk. They are validated in what's occurred, but they have a multiplier effect by loving the one they're with. That is, to start with loving themselves. A lot of them hate themselves because they blame themselves for what had occurred. It's another whole strange story, part of it. Changing the world, one encounter at a time, is not all there is. I've mentioned that. Group action, political action, etc., has its place. But Hashem's plan, exemplified in Yeshua, starts with love the one you're with. That's where it starts. Then watch to see the reverberations of your love multiply to other people over time, and that is call it a big part of God's plan for making the world a better place and facilitating to some extent. Ultimately, Yeshua has to bring it, but facilitate world peace. Shabbat Shalom, everyone.
Our God, may the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord, our God, may the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. In the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. In the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. And may your descendants and the descendants of your people, Israel,